The topic that we're going to look at arises from basically from correspondence between the Communist Workers' Organisation, the Free Communists, and various members of the Midland Discussion Forum in response to events which have been going on very recently in places like Ukraine, Western Kurdistan, or Rojava as it seems to be called, and even closer to home in Bonnie, Scotland. For good measure, if you wanted to, you can throw in the nauseating commemorations for the First World War that we've been suffering since the beginning, well, it seems like the beginning of time, but it was the beginning of last year, and all the commemorations that have followed it ever since. Of course, the latest of these were last month with the commemorations on the same day of the Gallipoli landing in Turkey, which defined the Australian and New Zealand nations as states in their own right, as their prime ministers were proud to say on the shores of Gallipoli. I can't quite understand why getting loads of people killed defines your nation, but apparently it did. As well as the Armenian massacres, which were also celebrated, but not in Turkey. This was not the only massacre of the First World War. Because by 1922, the Turkish nation, to define itself, to replace the Ottoman Empire, was also carrying out massacres of Greeks in the town of Smyrna, which is now known as Izmir, creating Kemalist Turkey from the ruins of the Ottoman Empire. Indeed, the breadth and depth of the problem of nationalism today is so widespread that I'm certain it was difficult to decide what to put in and what to leave out, and I'm sure none of us would have agreed on the contents of this talk if they hadn't left it to me. It certainly merited us asking for a 2-hour slot to discuss the issue, and this is obviously to give time for everyone to contribute. That's if I ever stop talking. Some people might want us to focus on the spreading menace of the extreme right, like UKIP, Jobbik in Hungary, the Front National in France, the Lega Nord in Italy, Pegida and the Alternative für Deutschland in Germany, Golden Dawn in Greece, and a host of equally unsavoury groups that I could carry on reciting for quite some time. Perhaps there is an interesting discussion to be had on that, on the way that how some of these are now enjoying more support by making their racism sound more rationalised, more rational, and talking just about the problem of immigration, whilst the others are quite content to remain marginal as thuggish minorities, just making life miserable for minority communities everywhere. But I don't think this is as significant as the general rise in the mainstream of capitalist political life, of identity politics in general, and nationalism in particular. Racism and nationalism are never very far away from the surface of political discourse, but in the face of the capitalist crisis, they take on a new purpose and a new life. So I'll give you my apologies now. I'm going to make a little sort of diversion to discuss the capitalist crisis, because the capitalist crisis, it seems to me, is quite central to explaining why we've had such a rise in racism and nationalism in the last few years. Obviously we don't want to spend too long on the crisis, but one of the axioms of the position of the Communist Workers' Organisation is that the fundamental analysis of Marx's Capital remains valid for our own time. Capitalist production involves enormous contradictions from which it cannot escape. The very forces that make capitalism the most dynamic mode of production hitherto known are also the same ones that create its basic problems. Marx noted that capitalist accumulation didn't go in a straight line, but in cycles. Every decade or so, the system suddenly
And apparently, inexplicably, or certainly inexplicable to capitalist economists, would suffer a crisis. Unlike the economic crises of the past, these were not crises caused by a lack of something, a scarcity, but by overproduction. But this overproduction did not mean that everybody was already had their basic needs satisfied. There was too much to sell, but no one to buy them, even though they lacked those basic necessities. The result was the actual starvation for any workers who lost their jobs. And those who lost their jobs often had to listen out for where they could get any job anywhere. The working class, in short, has always been a class of migrants moving to find the work that capitalism was so reluctant to find them. In the 19th century, though, when Marx was writing, the crisis allowed the capitalists who had enough capital to survive the crisis to buy out their rivals, usually at knockdown prices. This is what we would call a devaluation. And once that was done, the cycle would begin again from a lower value base, but this time with a greater concentration and centralisation of capital. The process was repeated several times during the 19th century until the concentration of capital created monopoly capitalism, and the internal competition inside each capitalist nation state became less significant than the competition between the leading firms of these national states. This brought forth the early defence of these firms by the state, both through things like tariffs and ultimately military action. As we used to write, trade wars were a precursor to shooting wars. Capitalism had now shifted in one decisive aspect. From now on, the concentration of capital was so great that only a massive and destructive devaluation of capital would bring about the profitable revival of the economic cycle. In the 20th century, capitalism's cycle of accumulation turned out to be an infernal cycle of imperialist wars costing millions of lives and wiping out capital values in a way never seen before. The imperialist war devalued the capital, then there was a boom, then there was the return of the slump, and this opened the way to the next imperialist war. This is what we saw in the first half of the 20th century. This is the world into which many of us just happened to be born just after that war. And the six-year war, the destruction of the 6 years from 1939 to 1945, led to a post-war boom, which has been the longest sustained boom in capitalist history. But like all the other booms, this boom too faded, despite the fact that in the 1950s we were told we had never had it so good and there would never be another crisis. And the same tendency for the rate of profit to fall meant that capitalism once again entered the crisis of the end of the cycle of accumulation. But this is where our epoch is different from the past. In the past, the nation state did not play a great deal of a role in the micromanagement of the economy and of society. With the domination of finance capital, the state has to maintain the conditions for ensuring the stability of the regime of accumulation. This is to short circuit a long process. This finally led, in the face of the crisis in 1986, to the assumption by both Labour and Tory governments that if they allowed the big bang, which was actually to deregulate the banks, the financiers could be left free to make money for the economy, and the only thing that they had to do was to attract foreign capital into the city of London or into Frankfurt or into Paris or into Milan or wherever. And of course the big boom did create an illusion. It created an illusion of capitalist recovery based on the notion that debt was now irrelevant and that somewhere down the line the surplus value to pay this debt would turn up. It was a kind of capitalist Micawberism. As an organisation, we predicted this would end in tears long before it happened. In fact, it took so long for it to happen, we started to wonder if we were wrong. because it seemed to go on and on. Capitalism seemed to be like a man who'd run off the end of the cliff and still was hanging there. Eventually, though, as everybody now knows, in 2007, the tears did come with the end of the financial speculative bubble all over the world. In fact, this was yet another vindication of Marx's capital, as he points out that the final act of every cycle in its downward phase is the creation of fictitious capital and speculation. And we're still in this phase. It's not over. The fictitious capital creation, though, has been transferred from the banks to the state. And the state debt, bank debt, has now become sovereign debt. And this is where we come in. Because who has to pay the sovereign debt back? Well, the states. So how does the states do it? Well, they attract finance capital. How do they attract finance capital? Well, they prove that they're prudent. How do they prove that they're prudent? They have a policy of austerity. And this is the sad cycle that we are currently in. And those who have had no connection with the financial crisis, the working class, we find ourselves paying for it. That here endeth the discourse on economics, as which would probably be a great relief to everybody. Well, moving off the dreary science, this is just the premise for what we're here to talk about today. If the ruling class is to make a frontal attack on the working class, there is a danger that they could provoke a class response. They're more aware of that than we are. To avert this, what better vehicle than some form of identity politics? And what more obvious identity than the country or the nation? And there is no doubt that over this phase of the end of the cycle of accumulation, i.e. the last 40 years, the playing on nationalism has increased across the globe. Just to give a banal example from the UK, when we were kids, we used to just take the mickey out of the flag and the nation and all the rest of it. But then came the Falklands War, and suddenly there were bloody Union Jacks everywhere, and they've never stopped being everywhere. They're mushrooming faster than any flowers in spring. This was a defining moment in this shift. Before then, nationalist notions had been largely confined to our parents nostalgically thinking about the Second World War, which of course they could think about it nostalgically because they'd survived it, but the rest of us don't have that sense of nostalgia. But now we've got to a situation where many have come to believe that talking about the country or this or that problem of the country or the nation is completely natural. But it isn't. Nationalism is anything but natural, if you think about it. It's an artificial construct. It actually arises as a product of the bourgeois revolutions at the end of the 18th century. Before then, there was no such thing as nation states, but only territories ruled by rulers. And we were not citizens of any state, but mere subjects. I know, okay, we're citizens and subjects in the UK, but the distinction is that in the past, you were the subject of a monarch, and that was how the feudal system had operated. But the bourgeois system, based on a wider class, social class, needed something else to legitimise the kind of property, the kind of property relations that they wanted to defend. So they couldn't very well say, well, all the rich can vote and nobody else could, although they actually did get around to that. What they did was they invented the notion of a citizen, that we all had rights before the law. And they claimed not just to speak for their own class, but for the entire nation. In the French Revolution, the third estate was everybody who wasn't an aristocrat or a member of the clergy, or the king. And so they could say, we are the leaders of the third estate. We're all in this together. I think you've heard that more recently. But the this was the essentially the message of the bourgeois revolution. And so behind the bourgeoisie, the lawyers, the professional classes, they brought in the downtrodden masses of the peasants, the artisans and the workers. And liberty, fraternity, equality were mighty sounding slogans in the 18th century. They were so powerful that people didn't realise that under the brave new bourgeois world, some were freer than others, and equality was only equality before the law, and it was a law that defended existing property rights and not the equality of individuals in the general sense. In fact, in the early stages of the bourgeois revolution, the idea of democracy was considered as dangerous as the idea of communism is today. So voting rights had to be restricted. French revolutionaries came up with a very clever trick. They decided everybody's a citizen, but some of you are passive citizens and some of you are active citizens. And you'll never guess who the active citizens were, the ones who owned all the property. So they got the right to vote. And this was how they intended to govern. But of course, they also had to turn the definition. We're talking about nation states, and they now had to define nation. This was a pretty tricky job for them. By the way, the word nationalism doesn't arise till the late 18th century. It arose from a German philosopher called Herder, who he was born in Prussia, but he hated Prussia because his notion of nationalism was it was cultural. So he wanted all Germans to be in one nation state, which of course was a ludicrous idea, because if all Germans were in one nation state, they would swamp Europe, a fact that Bismarck realised. Herder also wanted, in the beginning of the 19th century, nationalism and liberalism were regarded as the same thing, giving democracy and, or not democracy, but some kind of representative rule and nationalism were the same thing, ought to create this new nation state. This was absolutely hated by the Prussian aristocratic Junker class that dominated Prussia, especially by its most gifted member. In fact, I would argue the most gifted politician of all time, a certain Otto von Bismarck, who hated liberalism, hated the very idea of revolution, so decided to make one himself. And what he did was he very cleverly put Prussia at the head of the German national movement in order to destroy the German liberal movement. And he created by 1870 a German state completely dominated by Prussia, completely dominated by a feudal aristocracy, and completely dominated by a system of representation which where the mass of the class, the mass of the population, got one third of the votes, the aristocracy got another third of the votes, and I can't remember who got the other third, but oh, it was the town middle class. They got the other third of the votes. So you get a system that's completely controlled. They're obviously not going to trust the masses with the vote. It's sometimes said that Marx and Engels supported German unification, but they did so only in an instrumentalist way. In the same way they supported Italian unification, this was also they supported in an instrumentalist way, which is they thought that by the creation of these nation states, this was the best form for capitalism to develop, and therefore to develop the basis on which the proletarian revolution would grow. They didn't actually support nationalism per se or without conditions or as such. In fact, if to give an example of what I'm trying to argue about why nationalism isn't natural, you can only need to look at Italy. In Italy, there was no Italian language as defined until 1827, when a man called Alessandro Manzoni wrote a book called I Promessi Sposi, or The Betrothed. The novel was an allegory against the Austrians about the way it was imprisoning the Italian state. But he wrote it in Italian. He thought he was writing it in the Italian of Dante, but in fact he was writing it in his own dialect from Milan. And this was the first defining document of the Italian language. For nationalists, quite important. Britain's first defining document was Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, so the Italians are a little bit behind the game here, and even more behind the game because the Italian state is created in a very romantic movement with lots of support from liberals in Britain. Garibaldi came over here, he even went to Newcastle, was feted and all the rest of it. And everybody thought Garibaldi united Italy, but he didn't. It was united by dirty tricks and dirty politics carried out by the Piemontese under King Victor Emmanuel of Piedmont. They united Italy, but most Italians did not speak Italian. 97% did not speak Italian. And in fact, there's an old story about it. I don't know if it's true or not, but I used to tell it as if it was. That when Garibaldi was, he marched in from Sicily, having conquered the Sicilian island, and marched into Napoli, and he was told, that the crowd were told, oh, you shout out, Viva Garibaldi e Viva Italia. And the crowd went, Viva Garibaldi. Well, they knew who he was. And then he went, Viva Italia. Is it the horse or is it his mistress? and in fact, it's quite true that most Italians did not have a concept of Italy until the First World War. Because it was, and nationalism had to be created. In fact, I can't quote a better one than the second Prime Minister of Italy, a man called Massimo D'Azeglio, who said in 1860, we have made Italy, now we have to make Italians. And of course that's what the bourgeoisie have to do. And you look at the states that have failed around the world today, why have they failed? They failed because they have had imposed on them the boundaries of a nation state by some imperialist power or another. That's, you can see them, the lines on the map, you know, the Middle East, Africa. These are artificial constructs, and it's no wonder they're falling apart, because they haven't had the historical time for them to generate an artificial nationalism to follow. Which brings us back to the question of identities. Whereas we put our class before all else, the bourgeoisie's weapon is always the appeal to nationalism. But from the days of the Communist Manifesto, Marxists have argued that the proletariat has no country, workers have no country. And it isn't just rhetoric. It's a material recognition that we have no property and that we go where we can to sell our labour power. As far as Marx was concerned, workers would have to settle things with their own bourgeoisie or their own capitalists first. But as the class relationship was the same everywhere, our struggle was from the beginning potentially international. Nation or class is just another expression of bourgeois or proletariat, or indeed class war. And just as nationalism is the ideology of the bourgeoisie in the class war, it only flourishes when they are on top. Except perhaps the classic exception is the First World War. In the First World War, the bourgeoisie went to war partly because, one of the reasons, obviously the main push was imperialist interest, but for some bourgeoisies, like the Russian and British, and if you ever want to get confirmation of the British attitude, read Lloyd George's memoirs, there's only 10 volumes that thick of them, you'll find there that Lloyd George said, we needed a war to offset all this syndicalist great unrest that had occurred since 1912. The same in Tsarist Russia. After 1905, strikes against the war went down. 1912, there's a strike in the Lena goldfield in Siberia. 200 workers are shot dead by the Okhrana, and from that day forth, the strike level in Russia goes up and up and up. And these strikes were political strikes, calling for an end to the monarchy. The result was that by 1914, the Tsarist regime had another edge of desperation in wanting to go to war. And of course, we were all right in 1914. We had the Socialist Second International. That had passed resolutions against the war and would call us all to fight against it. Well, we all know what happened. We also know that the same thing happened to many of the anarchist and anarcho-syndicalist groups as well. That in the face of the threat of war, they all said, oh, we can't leave the country in the lurch. They all found different reasons, always progressive reasons, like Kropotkin's famous one, for supporting Tsarist Russia was, oh well, we've got to defend France against the Prussian monarchy. He was living in France at the time, of course. But I mean, that was a very convoluted way to come to the support of the Tsar. But the biggest betrayal of all was the Second International, because the Second International was the largest organised body of workers in history, and the betrayal that it carried out, apart from the exceptions of the Russian Bolsheviks, the Bulgarian Tesniaki, and the Serbian Socialist Party, every other major contributor to that Second International voted war credits for their government. And this was a piece of betrayal which I would argue the working class has never really recovered from since. So the Second International collapsed under a wave of betrayal and jingoism. But as I said, keep arguing, the nationalism is a superficial, artificial concept, and it only works when the nation works. Once the reality of the mechanized war and the horrors and destruction of trench warfare gradually filtered down to people's psyche or to people's consciousness, then the question became slightly different. And of course, here the main credit should go to Lenin, because Lenin was almost alone in standing up to say that we have got to turn this imperialist war into a civil war. And he was roundly derided and laughed at. But within 3 years of this carnage that imperialists had brought on the world, the Russian Revolution had broken out, and it set in chain a series of resistances and revolutions which brought an end to the war. It was not the war wasn't ended by the armed forces, it wasn't ended by the bourgeoisie, it was ended by the working class rejecting the nationalist lie that dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. In fact, so resistant had the working class been to the idea that you no longer died for king and country, that next time round they had to think up something slightly more sophisticated. Not so much in the defeated countries or the countries that did work badly out of the peace. Straightforward revenge nationalism would do in Italy and Germany, and fascism would be the solution. But in the Western democracies, it wasn't enough just to say, we're going to fight for the country now. Now we had to fight for something a lot more abstract, anti-fascism. And anti-fascism became the slogan of the allies of the Second World War, even allowing Stalin, Roosevelt and Churchill to get together to fight. But at the end of the day, anti-fascism was no different from nationalism in being another justification for the defence of imperialist power. And of course, in the Second World War, even more people were destroyed, even more people, even more property was destroyed than in the First World War. It was an incredibly bitter and long war. In Russia alone, 20 million reckoned to have died.
27 to,
exactly. If you read Russia Today, listen to Russia Today, you'll get an even more exaggerated number. In fact, sometimes when you see the statistics of who died, you have to ask who's doing the counting. But anyway, if I can leap from the Second World War to the more modern period. I'm not going to go into all the examples, obviously, which would be a great relief to hear, but just to mention the question of the Ukraine. Since the Ukraine was one of the places which had the most devastation in the Second World War, and Ukraine was once the breadbasket of first Russia and then the USSR. Since the Orange Revolution of 2004, which was largely funded and supported by the West, it's become the centre of an imperialist struggle for influence. Over 3/4 of the population speak Ukrainian, and only 17% speak Russian and live mainly in the east of the country. The pro-Western elements have not only talked up Ukrainian nationalism, but have allowed the fascist far-right sector to mushroom and gain some power in the zone. They're the ones who attempted, I don't know if you remember it, a bit of ethnic cleansing in Odessa in May last year, with the setting on fire of a building in which there were several Ukrainian, several Russian nationalists, leading to the deaths. I can't remember how many, but it was at least 50 and probably 80. And this is typical of identity politics, because there's nothing like a good atrocity for reinforcing identity politics. We saw that in Northern Ireland with the tit-for-tat killings. Who does the killings? Every time they do a killing of the other side, it reinforces support for their side. And this is the kind of problem that a small minority can actually create for the majority who don't want to to follow their line. And in Ukraine, in Ukraine, the last opinion poll before the war started said that 3/4 of Russian speakers did not want any pro-Russian rising of any kind. What we have, in fact, is a small pro-Russian rising assisted by outside forces from Russia. And we now know that not only are the 6,000 Russian troops in eastern Ukraine, but 220 of them have died, and their families have each been paid $300,000 to sign an agreement not to mention where they died. So the nature of the area is quite clear. But of course, wherever you go, you get these kind of propaganda. Remember Odessa, stop fascism. And what they're doing is the Russian side, the pro-Russian side, are playing on the anti-fascist message again. But really, it's a Russian nationalist message. Because what they're saying is, all the people in the West are the same people who supported Stepan Bandera, the fascist or quasi-fascist Ukrainian nationalist from the Second World War, who sided with the Nazis and was anti-Semitic. This is absolutely not true. They don't even think about it. 3 million Ukrainian citizens died in the Red Army. Less than 100,000 joined Bandera's army to fight. So this is again another nationalist lie. But the same nationalist lies, of course, are also appearing on the other side, on the Ukrainian side. They're talking about now Ukraine is independent from the tyrannical Soviet Union, from the tyrannical Putin. But in fact, the ones on the Western side are being financed by George Soros, John McCain, and all sorts of Western financial institutions. But of course, the name of the game is we're fighting for the Ukrainian language and the Ukrainian nation. And the war is reducing both Ukraine and Russia to ruins. I saw figures on the telly last night. Russia's GDP will fall by 8% this year. Ukraine's will fall by 10 times that much. This is a war that nobody wants, that is imposed by small nationalist gangs. The sad thing is that finding people to stand up in the area against this nationalist nonsense has proved to be harder than we thought. The best example was the declaration of the internationalists of the CRAS, an anarcho-syndicalist group in Russia, who have come out with a declaration against the war, which is, you can find it on Libcom if you want to see. And the good news is that many groups locally in Ukraine and in Russia have signed it, but there's also many that have been taken in by various aspects of this struggle to call for support, just like the Trotskyists who are always dividing themselves and calling for support for both sides in an imperialist conflict. There are many on the Ukrainian side who are also doing the same. For example, there's a group called the Autonomous Workers Union of Ukraine. We, early in the conflict, we thought it was quite good and borrowed material from it, but they've recently issued statements saying things like the Maidan was the beginning of like workers' councils or some kind of popular representation, and that this was a way forward, and so they're tending to support the Kiev government.
So they're deviating from internationalist principles on this one. And of course, the whole business in Eastern Europe is dangerous for everybody. Only last week in Estonia, RAF jets took on the Russian Air Force over the skies of Estonia because both sides were carrying out military manoeuvres at the same time. So the tension and the escalation is heating up. How are we doing?
All right.
Matter of opinion.
10-15 minutes.
I'm going to leave out anti-fascism as a cover for nationalism, as in Western Kurdistan, Rojava. I'm sure there's plenty of people who've got plenty to say on that. It was interesting to see a Rojava flag scarf down in the hall before we came up. But it's something we need to discuss. I'm just going to look to an example closer to home, and the curious case of Scottish nationalism. I should be an expert on it, but I'm not. Revolutionaries are neither for nor against any particular form of political arrangement the capitalist class want to make. After all, to oppose Scottish nationalism is to be in favour of British nationalism. We oppose them all. What we have turned our criticism on is the illusions being bought and sold by those who claim to be for the working class, both north and south of the border. They argue the Scottish working class would be better off in a non-Tory, non-Blairite Scotland. Apart from the wonderful lack of solidarity, which says that the English working class can be left to the Tories, this is actually a fantasy. The SNP has skillfully outmanoeuvred the Labour Party, which is not only known in Scotland to be totally corrupt at local level, especially ever since Unite got its hands on the most of the local parties, but it's also seen after Mr. Blair as a second Tory party, since adopting Blairism has made that the Labour Party has moved to the right. But the SNP's claim to be a party for the workers, mind you, everybody's claiming to be a party for the workers, even Cameron now, but the SNP's claim to be a party of the workers needs to be put under the spotlight. Nobody seems to be noticing their welcome for globalised big business all over Scotland. It only comes to light occasionally when Donald Trump starts to trash the coast of Aberdeenshire to build a golf course, or if we discover that INEOS have got sweetheart deals with the Scottish government as long as they keep on working at Grangemouth. This is what the SNP is doing at one level. And the record for the working class isn't that great. Despite the fact that they've got more money per capita than the English, they haven't done so fantastically well. True, university education remains free in Scotland. But they don't tell you that this came at the price of dismantling the further education system, which was the backbone of Scottish education. And on the poverty question, I'm going to quote a certain G. Mooney of the Open University, who in 2014 did a survey, and he said that there's a lot wrong with Scotland, and it's getting worse. This is after years of SNP devolved government. 870,000 people in Scotland live in poverty. Population of Scotland, 4.5 million. It says 17% of the population here. 20,000 children in Scotland still live in poverty. That's 20% of all children in Scotland. Poverty in Scotland is significantly higher than in many other European countries. Poverty exists across Scotland. Nearly all local authorities in Scotland have council wards with over 20% of their children living in poverty. During the first 10 years of devolution, this is him speaking, not me. During the first 10 years of devolution, a period when New Labour were in power, there was much welcome fall in the levels of poverty in Scotland, particularly child poverty. In fact, some of you may remember that J.K. Rowling gave the royalties from Harry Potter to the Labour Party on the basis of it.
However, the picture for the immediate future shows that not only that the modest reductions have been halted, but there will be an increase in the levels of poverty in Scotland, as in other areas of the UK. By 2020, it is estimated that an additional 100,000 children in Scotland will be living in poverty. Of course, it should be added that I doubt if the situation will be any better for English children, but the whole idea that the wonders of nationalism can just evaporate the crisis that is international and everywhere is a myth. And this is, unfortunately, what a lot in the left in Scotland are trying to peddle. In the case of Scotland, nationalism has become like a cargo cult. It's the last hope for a lot of people, for a system that's abandoned them, and it disguises the fact that it is the system that is at fault, and that is our bone of contention with the nationalist issue here. And to abandon a class analysis is just to foster the illusions in nationalism. At the moment, nationalism is everywhere in the ascendant, and its dangers cannot be underestimated. But it's largely in the ascendant because we have been losing the class war. It's been going on for decades. But as our example from the First World War shows, history can often take sudden turns in different directions, so all is yet to play for. We don't know when or even if this will happen, but we do know that against all nationalist mystifications, we take a class position which is to oppose all capitalist ideologies of identity. In face of all of them, we are revolutionary defeatists. In the question of nation or class, there can be no compromise, since class war is the only way to halt the wars that capitalism is already waging and is also preparing. Thank you.